passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out, and when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. And Joe and I are here on one of our rewatch episodes. And we are going to talk about the 2000 Louisiana Lafayette Cajuns, as they were known then. Today they are just the Louisiana Raging Cajuns. This episode is part of our series where we go back and rewatch classic games from college baseball history. But we're going to take a little bit of a different spin on this. And instead of really like bearing down on this particular game, we kind of want to talk more about this Cajuns team, kind of what they represent, both in college baseball and in terms of Louisiana history, just breaking through as a program. But we'll be doing that with Raging Cajuns assistant Anthony Babineau. He will join us here in a few minutes. But before then, Joe, I have to check in with you and see how you are doing. It is a rainy day as we record this in Durham, North Carolina, and this is supposed to be conference tournament week. We're supposed to be just a few days away from Selection Monday. Instead, here we are. Looking back on the 20th anniversary of this Raging Cajuns team.
Yeah, I did think about that earlier today, that granted the ACC tournament was going to be in Charlotte this year, not in Durham, but I had a thought to what it would have been like if it had rained as much as it is going to this week. So today is Wednesday as we record. Thursday is actually supposed to rain a little harder, but it has rained pretty much all day today, off and on, kind of a steady rain. Yesterday rained pretty much all day, and then tomorrow will as well. And I had a thought to, you know, how much of a mess that might have been had they still been having the ACC tournament at Durham. And because it's not so much that it's been lightning, so the lightning would not have been an issue. But as we know, you can play with it raining, but typically teams don't like to start games while it's raining. They typically like to wait for a little bit of a window, and maybe a conference tournament situation where you have to get those games in somehow changes the calculus a little bit. But I have to imagine it would not have been necessarily a fun time to be trying to squeeze conference tournament games in. And I mean, that's just kind of the way it goes this time of year, though. You know, it's the springtime for everybody, and you know, in places in the South, that means that the humidity, which causes some of these thunderstorms in the Midwest, it means that it's kind of the rainy season. So nobody's really immune from it. And as a result, somebody in conference tournament week is always getting hosed in terms of the weather. On a different note, because this really is, I mean, it's been a beautiful spring.
Like I want to point out though that you know, you're talking about just windows and everything, but it rained Tuesday. It's now Wednesday. It's raining, and you're telling me it's supposed to rain again tomorrow. Like at some point, the field just takes on too much water. Like that becomes more of a concern than windows or anything. Just, you know, these games, yes, they're happening in really good AAA stadiums, but it can only take so much abuse ultimately.
I mean, that's a good point. DBAP is grass. Is that correct? Natural?
Yes,
natural
that is
grass.
Correct.
Yeah. So I guess minor league facilities typically are versus college. So yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, it rains all day tomorrow and suddenly you've got kind of a mess on your hands. Maybe they would have ended up having to shorten the bracket somehow. And I don't know. They still do pool play in ACC. So I don't know how that would have worked out, but alas, we'll never find out, I suppose. On a different note, because like I mentioned last time, it's been like a really, really beautiful spring, at least the last few weeks here. And this rain has been a little bit different. These are the first days I can remember in a while where it's rained all day. We've had days where it's rained and then kind of gone away. And in the afternoon, the clouds open up a little bit, but this is the first days in a while I can remember it really raining. And I woke up a couple of days ago. I don't know if you're a little bit younger than me. So I don't know if you've hit this part of becoming an old person yet, but I kind of woke up middle of the night the other night and my knee hurt and was like, man, something is going on. And like, sure enough, that rain the next day, like those weather, those pressure changes are starting to get to my body. I used to laugh at like my mom when she'd talk about her joints hurting whenever the pressure in the air changed. And I used to think that was just, yeah, I don't know what I thought it was, but I thought she was making it up. But lo and behold, here I am at the relatively young age of 32 years old. And my knees start hurting me a little bit whenever the pressure changes outside.
Yeah, I cannot say I've hit on that, or at least that I've noticed that's happening yet. So
I mean, I am nursing that. I've kind of got this like nagging knee injury, which is probably like exacerbating the problem. But it was definitely already happening a little bit. You feel the differences in pressure, and certainly that has been the case this week. We went from 90 degrees on Saturday, essentially 90 and sunny, to, you know, now it's, I don't know, like 55 degrees outside, and you can't see the sun, and it's been drizzling all day.
This actually reminds me of the SEC tournament a few years ago. I don't remember precisely what year it was. I guess it was Mingione's first year at Kentucky, so 2017. It's a great way to remember things. but you know, it was weirdly cold and rainy, and the ball was flying out of Hoover, which traditionally is more of a pitcher's park, and everyone was trying to figure it out and like why that was happening. And one of the theories posited was, well, it's a lot colder than it usually is, so maybe that's why. But anyway, yeah, you never know what you're going to get conference tournament week. And of course, this year, conference tournament week, we get nothing. That's what we get. So what we do instead is we look back 20 years and we talk about the Louisiana Lafayette Raging Cajuns. Now, Joe, you picked this game. It's an Omaha game between the Cajuns and San Jose State. Taking place there in the 2000 College World Series. And, you know, while we're not going to hammer through some of the details of this game, I did want to kind of let you explain why we're looking back on this game and then kind of the Cajuns more broadly.
There's a couple of reasons I put it on the list initially. And by the way, if you listened to our last episode when we teased this game, I talked about, I don't even know if it's a good game. Turns out, pretty good game. Like, I enjoyed it. It's relatively low scoring, at least as far as some Omaha games at Rosenblatt could be. But they're relatively well pitched, and it moved pretty quick. But there was still, you know, a couple balls get out of the yard, and you got some runners on base. And so it really was kind of a fun game. I don't know what I was expecting exactly, but it was a lot of fun to watch. And so we chose this game for a couple of reasons. One is that it's just rare in the history of the College World Series that you have two true underdog stories. And I've used the term Cinderella before, but maybe that sells what ULL at the time was accomplishing. They were really good in 99, and Coach Babineau talks about that, you know, how good they were in 99 versus, as a lead into 2000. But they were two underdog teams at that point. And so that's kind of interesting. There are also two teams that kind of came at things different ways. I mean, this was, at least on the ULL side, this really was the culmination of something that had been building there under Tony Robichaud for a while. And they get to the precipice of it in 99 and then get over the hump in 2000. And then we would see as time went on, you know, the continued fruits of that, whether it was, you know, they really turn into a consistent regional team. You know, they're in regionals every other year, every third year. They peak again in, you know, 2014 in particular, but really that range of 13, 14, 15, they're really peaking again. So this was really the big crowning achievement of what had been a larger program build for ULL. And there's a discussion to be had about, you know, being able to pull something that often like that off in modern college baseball. And then you had San Jose State, which was really coming at it from a different standpoint of them really being the true Cinderella. They had been a solid program under Sam Ferraro, who was their head coach at that time, but they had really accomplished nothing like this to that point. They'd really had some nice individual seasons, but no postseason. And then boom, they get into the CWS in 2000. Now, I did sell them a little bit short. I think on the last episode, I talked about how, you know, they really didn't do anything like this again, or before. And I know I looked again and actually they get to a super regional in 02, which I had just kind of forgotten. So this really was maybe the beginning of a really short window for San Jose State to get something like this done. But after that 02 super regional, they don't go to the postseason again under Ferraro. And so it really is a very brief snippet in time of when San Jose State has this like supernova moment where they get to Omaha and then 2 years later they host and win 45 games. And so they are kind of your more true, I would say, Stony Brook type of Cinderella in Omaha. And so it's not just rare that you have these individual, I mean, how often does a team of San Jose State's caliber get to Omaha? And then furthermore, how often, and the answer is not often at all, do two teams like ULL and San Jose State end up playing in the College World Series? So I really enjoyed this game, even without having seen it and without knowing much about it. I kind of blindly put on the list just because I think this is such a rare bird of a game in CWS history. It ends up being a window into the best moment in the history of San Jose State baseball. And I guess arguably the best moment, actually almost inarguably the best moment in ULL baseball history. Although I think what makes that different is the idea that ULL could conceivably do this again. Life has gotten harder in doing that in the Sunbelt Conference, but they could conceivably do it again. And they came close on a couple of other occasions. So it's a little bit different in that regard, but it's just such a wonderful snapshot of the best moments in the history of these two programs that came at this from different directions and since then have kind of gone in different directions. So a lot going on here. And then on top of it, it was a really nice surprise that it turns out to be kind of a fun game.
So the, you know, Joe mentions there, like, just how rare it is that two programs like this meet. And, you know, Joe said that on the last podcast, and he's probably told me that offline too. And I've just kind of been like, yeah, I mean, I guess is probably pretty rare, but like, is it really that rare? And as someone that just looked through the last 40 years of College World Series matchups, it is that rare. Basically, this stands alone in the rarity. There are times where programs like Wichita State, Fresno State, and Rice have played each other. Those are all like real things that happened, or like Irvine played Fullerton in 2007. And so there are these games between teams outside the large power structure of college baseball hierarchy. But, you know, those teams that I just mentioned, they're not, you know, for the most part, you know, in these games, they're not first timers for the most part, at least not both teams. Most of the time, the teams that I'm talking about already had a national title by the time they're playing these games. Some of that is helped by the fact that Fullerton has had national titles for 50 years now or whatever. But to have two teams in their first time as, you know, that were at least at the time as far removed from the power structure as these two teams kind of were, basically it never happens. Since the tournament has stopped being, you know, the pure regional format that sent Maine to the College World Series in Northern Colorado. And, once they changed the format in the mid 80s to stop the true regionals, we really haven't seen anything like that, and except for this instance. And so it is a really special game from that standpoint. And Joe and I are going to get into that a little more after we speak with Anthony Babineau about this team. But, I also think that the Cajuns as a whole, this is just a team that gets referenced a lot in college baseball history, I feel like. And, it's a, some of that is just because of how far they go in Omaha. It's not just that they show up and win a game or go 0-2 and go home, but no, they were very competitive out there. And, they really did seem to capture a lot of hearts and minds of college baseball fans in a way that those around college baseball continue to talk about them. And I do think part of it is also just how much people in college baseball respected Tony Robichaux and liked him. And of course, unfortunately, Coach Robichaux passed away last July after complications from a heart attack. And he had a lot to do with he built this program. People, just so many people, had amazing things to say about Tony Robichaux, and a lot of them weren't really related to baseball, though he was a great baseball coach who won more than 1,000 games throughout his career at McNeese and ULL. But it was a lot about the way he impacted people away from the diamond as well. So I think all of those things come together to kind of create this, the aura around this 2000 Raging Cajuns team that did so well and broke through to the College World Series. So with that, let's talk to assistant coach Anthony Babineau. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we are very excited to be joined by Louisiana assistant coach Anthony Babineau. Coach, it's a weird time. It's a weird spring in college baseball, but how are you kind of just managing this baseballless spring at this point?
Well, you're absolutely correct. It definitely is a weird time and a weird spring. Never have any of us ever had one like this, So we're trying to manage as best we can. The season got cranked up, and for us, we played 17 games and had won. We got off to a little bit of a slow start, but had won 6 of our last 7. So we were really playing consistent baseball, coming around, kind of finding ourselves as a team. And then everything got cut. It came to a screeching halt. So that was really, for lack of better words, devastating in a sense, because you're a competitor, you're used to competing, especially this time of the year for us and our sport, and then all of a sudden you can't, and then next thing you know, you're at home and you can't go into work, and then next thing you know, you're having to communicate to your players via text and not face-to-face, and then you're having Zoom meetings, and then all of a sudden you start planning for 2021 in the middle of the spring of 20. So that's definitely something different, but we've gotten through it just like I suspect every other program has. We've gotten through the semester. Our guys really finished up great in the classroom, finished with a team GPA of 3.4 for this semester, which was a record for our program for a semester. So the guys really buckled down and did what they needed to do in the classroom. We had exit meetings with our guys via Zoom, and to this point have sort of put together our team for next year, or for this fall at least, and are just looking forward to the fall. We hope and pray each day that we can have a fall and we can get back at this come August, end of August. So, that's kind of where we have our sights set right now.
Well, let's take the trip down memory lane to some happier times in Cajun baseball history. Let's get to that 2000 team. That team was a breakthrough team, reaching the College World Series, of course. But in a lot of ways, the stage for that was kind of set by the 1999 team and all that they accomplished. What did that experience, playing Rice in a super regional and falling a little bit short of getting to the World Series, what did that bring What did the guys learn that they were able to carry over into 2000?
Well, that 99 season no doubt fueled our fire for 2000. We got really, really close in 99. And to be honest with you, myself included, and I was too young and naive in my career to be able to process and understand otherwise. After that first win on Friday night against Rice, no way did I or many of our players think that we were not going to Omaha. Now, even though we had never been there before and knew how tough it was to get there, we just felt that our chances to win one game out of the next two, it was a done deal. We were going to get there. Unfortunately, they took the next two from us and they advanced and we didn't. But, you know, one thing that did teach us was it's never over till it's over, for sure. And, you know, that we returned that entire team in 2000. We had one addition, position player-wise, to the outfield that really bolstered our offense even more, added a couple of arms. But for the most part, the entire team came back. So it wasn't as if we had to train new players, so to speak, on our history or, you know, our philosophy or where we were headed. Everyone was headed in the same direction. And after that 99 season at our postseason banquet, one of the local TV stations, their sports director had put together a video of the entire season, a really, really well done. And the last image in that video was a picture of Rosenblatt Stadium, and the caption was Omaha 2000. And I know for me and many of the players, like, that was the beginning of our journey towards Omaha, and there was going to be no denying us. So, as you mentioned, you know, with the start of this question, that 99 really catapulted us into 2000, same group of guys, same mentality, even a more fierce mentality, a stronger desire to get there because we came so short in 99. And, you know, fortunately for us, the season went as planned, not without some setbacks, you know, a 9-game losing streak, I believe, in the middle of that season. But we're able to rebound from that and really do what we needed to do, you know, to punch our ticket all the way through, as tough as it was, getting through South Carolina and the team that they had, 56-5, I believe, going into the Super Regional. I can still vividly remember the killer bees, the three bees that they had on the mound, Bauer, Balk, Knight, and I forget the last B, but I know his name started with a B, and just tremendous arms and a tremendous team, and losing Friday night. But, you know, the thing about losing that Friday night, our game one in that Super at South Carolina, we sort of knew how to handle that because, you know, the prior year we had seen the way Rice handled it. So we knew it could be done. We had seen it done. And fortunately, we were able to manage the situation and punch our ticket and make that historic trip.
I don't want to sidetrack us too much this early on, but as someone who grew up in Houston, I'd love to know that 99 Super Regional was played in the Astrodome. And I'd be curious to know how bizarre that kind of was to be playing college baseball in that building. I can imagine the ping of the bat probably echoed for hours afterwards, just given how big that place was.
Well, it did, you know. And at that time, you know, nowadays we play, as do other programs, play in pro parks all the time with tournaments that pro parks put on, and especially a lot of the minor league facilities that host tournaments. You know, you do it all the time, so it's kind of like second nature now. But back then, you know, 20 years ago, you weren't playing in pro parks a lot. So, you know, it was a huge deal for us, especially here in Louisiana, in Lafayette, South Louisiana. We obviously have the hometown New Orleans Saints football, but for pro baseball, you know, it's the Astros for us. Houston is the closest franchise to us. So a lot of our players, coaches grew up watching, listening to the Astros, going to some of the Astros games in the Astrodome. And a lot of our team was from Texas, in particular the Houston area. So that was a big deal for those guys as well. So just to get the opportunity to play there. And I think that, you know, kind of maybe helped and made us feel a little bit more comfortable at being there in a pro park, even though we hadn't had a lot of experiences with playing in professional stadiums. The fact that we had all been inside the Astrodome, you know, whether it be for watching an Astros game or for probably a lot of the Houston guys, because we had a lot of Cowboys on that team going to the rodeo, you know, inside the Astrodome. So it was somewhat of a familiar setting for us. But, you know, it definitely was different because, you know, all of our games were, for the most part, in outside venues. And then you get inside and, you know, especially with the roof and the ceiling and tracking the balls, it was definitely different.
So then fast forward to 2000, you end up hosting a regional that year as a two seed. What do you remember about that atmosphere? I have to imagine, given, you know, how much excitement there was about this season potentially being a breakthrough, I have to imagine that weekend was pretty crazy in Lafayette.
Yeah, it surely was. You know, we didn't – back then they didn't announce the host sites as early as they do now. So we kind of sweated out all the way to the end. You know, I think a third – a little bit before halfway of the season is when we got up to number four in the ranking. We were 30-4, I believe, at one point, and just really cruising along. I mean, we had beaten some good teams. We swept Oklahoma at home. We swept another P5 school, I believe, at home or on the road, just really just knocking out everybody. And then we go on that mid-season 8 or 9 game losing streak. It began at FIU. They were in our conference back then. I think we won Friday night, then lost Saturday, Sunday. And then from there, we went to a Tuesday, Wednesday at Wichita State midweek series, dropped both of those games. On the way back down, stopped at Little Rock for a conference series, got swept by them. So, you know, we went through that struggle, and then obviously our ranking kind of fell some after that stretch. So we had to do some work to kind of get back up into the conversation. And end of the year, we were kind of back into that conversation as far as being a host. And then the last weekend of the season, we hosted UNO at home. And we had one game to win to clinch a conference championship. And they swept us at home. And we were just totally devastated. I can still see the pictures that came out in the newspaper that after that weekend series, you know, guys with their head in their hands. I think the headline was something like dejected or rejected or something like that. And, you know, so we dropped those last three at the end of the season. And obviously, as you guys know, the committee takes a look at your last 10 and how you finish up. Well, we went to the conference tournament. I think we lost the first game. Then we won the next three. Then we lost that following game to eliminate us before the championship. And we came back home, and we knew we were going to be in a regional, obviously, but we didn't know if we were going to host. And we all gathered in our athletic director's office for that selection show, that process, and had it on speakerphone. And you know, we were the last site that was announced. And I can remember, you know, myself, I can remember the look on Coach Robichaud's face and him and the athletic director embraced, because that was the first time that we would get to host a regional, and we had put in so much work and gotten so many commitments from the community to help with some upgrades to the ballpark in preparation to be able to host a regional. So just overjoyed for the entire community, the school, the athletic department, and our obviously our team. And, you know, I really think that it's well documented even to this day that the teams that host are the teams that advance. You obviously have a lot of teams that advance, and we've done it from other regional sites, not our own, but the majority of teams that advance are the host. And that held true that year, even though we had a tremendous East Carolina team that came in that season. A lot of those guys, obviously, I didn't know who they were then, but I sure know who they are now, because I think 8 of those 9 everyday players went on to become coaches, and all guys that I'm friends with today as we all kind of came through the coaching ranks. So even though we had that stiff competition, the fact that we were at home and had sold out crowds and had the excitement and the atmosphere that our stadium and our town and is so well known for, that was able to help us get through that regional and move on into the Supers.
So, if you go back and look at a lot of images, or if you see any video from that World Series team, the guys are almost all blonde. When did they go ahead and decide that they were going to, you know, join up in a show of team unity and dye their hair blonde?
Well, that actually started, you know, just like this run started with the 99 team, the hair started with the 99 team as well. They did that towards the end of the season. We all had blonde hair I don't think we had it, you know, that year we were in the Houston regional and won that regional in Houston. I don't think we had the blonde hair then, but I think the next week before we went to, well, back to Houston for the Supers is when guys started to dye their hair. And I think while we were there before the first game, the last couple of guys that were resisting did it. Coach Robichaud even did it. So the hair started before the 2000 season with the 99 team. And then obviously once we got into postseason for 2000, you know, it came back. So that was started prior to 2000.
I'm curious a little bit about that, the way the South Carolina Super Regional ends. There was an article Luke Johnson of The Advocate did five years ago or so, where, you know, he talked to you about it and you mentioned that you were able to, that's a crystal clear memory for you to that day. And I'm curious how, if you ever had a memory similar to that in terms of, you know, being able to remember something so clearly, or if that stands alone as the type of memory in your baseball life that you can remember in that way.
Well, as far as in my baseball life, you know, that definitely is one of the best memories. You know, I remember a little bit the interview with Luke that you mentioned, and, you know, I'm fairly certain that I said that the memory of that ground ball going into Scott Atwood, our first baseman's glove, and I remember when he caught the ball, to me, he appeared too far off the bag to run and tag the bag for the final out. In my mind, I was thinking, we still got to make a clean exchange between Scott and the pitcher. So I remember just thinking, clean exchange, please, clean exchange, clean exchange, and we've got this done. And then as Scott's going towards the bag, you know, he puts his glove up to the pitcher to signal that I've got it. And when he put that glove up, you know, I just knew that he was going to get to the bag before the runner and that we had accomplished this goal. I can see that as if it was yesterday. I really can. And this, then just the embrace that myself and Coach Robichaud, Coach Simino, Coach Gonzalez, just all of our staff, everyone just – It was complete euphoria, so to speak. It really was. So, you know, that image is that whole weekend, though. I mean, if we had enough time, I could go through that whole weekend from game one, game two, game three, everything that happened pregame, postgame. I really can. You know, you have certain memories that stick out for you. You know, that memory was certainly one. Just yesterday, I was on with someone here locally to speak about our 2014 team. And for the most part, that entire season, I can remember as it played out. You know, we all have things that get etched in our memory from special times. And for us, for baseball, special seasons. You know, I was asked if I can remember throughout my whole 25-year career all of the teams and how seasons played out and what was the toughest to remember. And, you know, for each season, I can pretty much remember things from each season. And when you have special teams or special seasons like 2000, 2014, you can really remember a little bit more because things stand out. You know, the toughest thing for me to remember is I can remember all the players, but some of the years that they played, you know, is a little bit tough for me to kind of remember just because there's been so many. But you take special years like 2000, 2014, and if you say a player's name, you know, I can definitely say, oh, he was on the 2000 team. He was on the 2014 team. So yes, that memory of South Carolina that weekend, I remember what I did after going back to the hotel. I can tell you who I called to let them know that we got it done. So, yeah, vividly remember everything about that exact moment, but more importantly, that entire weekend.
So then you get to Omaha, and that's a city that, you know, over the years has been known to embrace an underdog. Did you guys feel that while you were there, or, you know, just what were your experiences with just the city of Omaha and being a part of, you know, the special atmosphere that is the College World Series?
Well, we definitely could feel the way the community Omaha embraced not just the underdog, but every team. And we were the underdog. You know, us and San Jose State that year were two first-time programs to the College World Series. So we could definitely feel that. Our memorabilia, I believe, that was on sale at all the souvenir shops just went flying off the racks. They couldn't get it in fast enough. And I believe at one point got to where there were no more that they had to sell. So it was, but as far as that experience, I remember when we came back and people asking me about it, I would tell them that whatever you see on TV, I know you watch it on TV every year, whatever you see on TV being there is 100 times better. It really is, because you just become immersed in everything that is Omaha. And, you know, our guys really embraced it, dropped a tough one to Stanford by a couple of runs that first day. And then, you know, came back and had a great game against San Jose State, and then had that thriller walk-off win on the push bunt that got thrown away against Clemson the next day, and then got off to a really, really great start against Stanford the next day, come out to a 6-0 lead and just thought that, hey, we're going to get this done and have another chance at them. And if we get that done, then we're in the championship, which, if things would have played out the same, would have been against LSU, who was in the other bracket, which that would have been just a complete, I don't even know the word, just a joy to be able to play those guys, a team that, you know, we play every year in the regular season, but to play a school of that caliber with the tradition and history that they have, what it would mean for our program, their program, the state of Louisiana, that would have been tremendous. But, you know, we performed when we were there. You know, we had guys that were tough, both mentally and physically, and they rose up to any challenge that we had. You know, I mentioned yesterday with our 2014 team, and it stands true with 2000. There are many parallels between those two teams. On both of those teams, any night out, we had 7 or 8 professionals on the field. Now, not obviously big league professionals, but we had guys that had an opportunity to play professional baseball, to play for a paycheck. So when you have, you know, 8 or 9 guys out on the field that are professionals, you're going to do better than most. Now, obviously, when you get to the College World Series, every team has 8 or 9 professionals for the most part. So you're kind of evenly matched. But we had guys that just love to compete, love to have fun with each other. We're totally bought into what, as a program, we were trying to accomplish, and it showed in our play. And, you know, we were there for 10 days. It felt like a month. But the way that they space out your games, where you play every other day, we were there for 10 full days and really, you know, in my opinion, got the most out of our experience.
I think it's safe to say this team is remembered extremely fondly, not just locally by folks in Lafayette and in Louisiana, but I think among college people who follow college baseball closely fondly remember this 2000 Cajuns team. And I'm curious why you think that group of guys really captured everyone's imagination in the way that they did.
Well, number one, I think it was their style of play. We played a fun brand of baseball. We had power. We had pitching. We could run. We could bunt. We could defend. We did a lot of things well. And I think once we got to the big stage, to Omaha, it was documented through Omaha that we had to get through South Carolina, which was the talk of the town that entire season, so to speak, with the players that they had, the way that they just rolled through the regular season. And people knew that we got through that gauntlet, so to speak, to get to Omaha, and then playing well in Omaha. And then we had the dyed hair, the walk-off against Clemson, the way we did it. We stole home one game, you know, which, you know, other teams were stealing home, but not a lot of teams were stealing home in Omaha, you know, and we did that. So I think we just captured the hearts of a lot of Americans, and a lot of people found out about the Raging Cajun baseball program those 2 weeks during the College World Series. And I think that they have sort of followed through. I know that there was this one young man that one game, I caught a foul ball. I was, you know, in the first base coaching box, and I caught a slow roller foul ball that came right to me. And I kind of just put it in my pocket and waited till the next inning to give it to someone. And so I come out for the next inning and just kind of walked over back behind the first base box. And there was this little kid that was there that I kind of just picked out, and I gave it to him. And I got back that summer and got a really nice letter from both the kid and his mom, and said how much it meant to the kid that I walked over and, you know, signed the ball and gave it to him, and stayed in contact with that kid and that family for, you know, another 4 or 5 years after that. So, you know, I think just those things mean something to people. You know, when you do things like that, they mean something to people. They remember you, and just the things that we were able to accomplish that season, I think it excited people and got people interested in what we were doing.
You're talking there about the style of play that team had, but I find that to kind of hold true throughout the course of, you know, at least the best Cajuns teams. Is that something that Coach Robichaux kind of, you know, put in these guys, or is that just, you know, kind of the way that, you know, the style of play is down in Lafayette? Like, where do you think that has come from over the years?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, Tony definitely did his best to instill that into his players, you know, and we tried to recruit those type of players because we knew that's how we wanted to play. You know, we knew that year in and year out, we were not going to get the blue chippers, so to speak, you know, that a lot of the what is termed the P5 programs now get. Now we would get one from time to time, but for the most part, we were a program that had to develop. We had to take good players. We had to take players that we thought were tough and develop their skill, whether it be on the mound, in the field, or in the batter's box. And that was something that Tony, throughout his 25 years at UL, constantly talked about. You know, he affectionately referred to it as throwdown. You know, he wanted our mantra to be throwdown. Whenever we walked into a stadium, he wanted the other team to have the mindset that, you know, we're going to have to strap it on tonight if we're going to have any chance to beat these guys, because they're going to get after it from innings one through inning nine. So definitely Tony did his best to try to put that into the guys, and that just kind of became our staple throughout the years. It really did. We tried to recruit players that had a little bit of power, that had some speed, because we, you know, stealing bases, obviously, you know, first base is really not scoring position, but once you get to second, the whole story changes. So, you know, we like to run. And that was really, that was Tony. Tony was a tough guy. He really was. You know, to a lot of people in the public, obviously Tony was a very well-spoken, well-mannered, polite Christian man. But behind the lines, behind the scenes, he could get after you. He really could. He did it in the right way. He did it in a respectful way. But there was no back down in him. He was just a tough dude, man. He really was. You know, that style of play, all of those teams throughout the years, they were really just a mirror image of him.
In hindsight, how important is it to, or how meaningful is it, I should say, to have this College World Series experience as a way to kind of celebrate what Coach Robichaux built in Lafayette, and to have it as this kind of crowning achievement of all of his work that he put in the program?
Oh, man, I think it's tremendous. I really do. You know, the fact that he was able to take his team. You know, he said this at the post game interview in '99 after the Super Regional at Rice. You know, he said that so many people throughout the years, and it's true because I was with him for every step of the way. So many people throughout the years have invited him to Omaha, and he would always tell them, "That's okay. You know, I'm going to go with my team one day," and we were able to make that come true. You know, he was able to take his team and not just take his team and be happy to be there, but to take his team, play four games, win two of them, capture the hearts of college baseball. So I think that really cements his legacy. You know, his legacy would have been the same, in my opinion, no doubt, even if we would not have had that College World Series appearance, just because of the impact he had on so many lives, both young and old. But the fact that we did have the success that we had with the Super Regional appearances and the College World Series appearance and the number one ranking and hosting regionals, you know, the things that go along with great seasons, I'm really glad that he was able to put that on his resume. I really am.
Well, Coach, we're glad that we were able to take this trip down memory lane. It's a fun team to remember and to talk about. Like we said, it's fun to, you know, look back at, especially during a spring where we have no baseball, and it's always a good time to remember what Coach Robichaud meant, not only to that program, but to college baseball in general. So we really appreciate you you taking the time to talk about all of that with us today.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure. You know, as you mentioned, and we started talking earlier, it's a tough time right now with this pandemic, and there's not a lot of certainty as to what's going to come. But hopefully this thing can get under control a little bit and we can get back out there in the fall and have some more baseball. Although we all believe it's going to look a little different, how different we still have no idea, but no doubt probably will look a little different. But anytime that I can reminisce about our program and you know, I've certainly been blessed these last 25 years to have spent it here alongside a man of great character and the coach and the person that Tony Robichaud was. It's such a tragic end to his life last summer. It really was. But I feel honored and blessed, as I said, to have spent 25 years of my life right alongside of him and everything that he did and meant to this program. So it's been my pleasure to speak to you guys today. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you again to Coach Babineau for joining us today on the Baseball America College podcast. Joe, that was a lot of fun to take that trip down memory lane. And, you know, he just has so much, you know, in his head about this team. It's kind of incredible that, you know, the stuff he can recall and, you know, how much, you know, the way that the program was building and all of these things that went into making this team 20 years ago that ultimately becomes, you know, this breakthrough team for the Cajuns and one of the best teams in program history.
Yeah, folks like him are really rare. And by that, I mean, he really is, you know, a true historian of this program, because he was with Tony Robichaud largely from the beginning of when Coach Rowe was building this thing up. And, you know, especially now in college baseball, and head coaches understand this and they support it. You know, assistants move on to go become head coaches, and some on the staff did. Wade Simino is actually in this game. They show, you know, Wade Simino coaching third base, and, you know, he goes on to be the head coach at Louisiana Tech, for example. There are other examples that have been on the staff. But, you know, he's been there through all of it. And that's fairly rare to have someone like that who can speak as cogently about the entire modern history of this program the same way the head coach could, because he's been there for every last bit of it. And, you know, if Matt Diggs gets this thing really rolling again, he'll be there for that too. And he could speak on that as well. So he's really kind of a treasure in that way, to be able to speak about the history of this program in that particular way, as opposed to just one particular moment in time. And he clearly loves talking about this moment in time. You could really hear it in his voice there, but he can really give you that full picture of here's where we started, here's where we went, and here's where we're going. And that's really, really rare, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, he's one of these assistants that has just been tied to a school for pretty much their entire career. And those guys are rare and they are special. And, you know, just what he can speak to from, you know, the way that things got built there at ULL. And I think he's been through, Joe, maybe you can confirm this for me, he's been through three name changes or two name changes. He's been at that school under three different names, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Southwestern Louisiana up until 2000. So in the 99 Super Regional, they were Southwestern Louisiana and then ULL. And then now, you know, athletically going by UL, the school is still technically University of Louisiana at Lafayette, but athletically they like to go by UL. There's a lot of confusion and, you know, about all of that.
Oh, it's a whole thing.
It is a whole thing. Like, I was trying to dance around it, but it is a whole thing. The folks who care a lot about, you know, their team being called UL will make sure you know about it. But yeah, so Southwestern Louisiana, ULL, and then UL in the most recent iteration.
Yeah, so I mean, to have that kind of perspective, you know, I really appreciate, and it's really cool to be able to look back on the way that the program grew, because, you know, before we really dug into this team, I didn't know a ton about the 99 Super Regional. I'm sure Little Joe was like in the Astrodome, you know, watching that. But like, if I had remembered that they played Rice in the Astrodome and a 99 Super, that sure had slipped my mind. But, you know, to see how close they were to reaching Omaha the year before, and then for them to rebound from what must have been a crushing defeat to lose the last two games of that Super and come back, and then, you know, the story of how they get to Omaha is pretty incredible, because that 2000 South Carolina team is one of the best teams in Ray Tanner's career, at least up until the 2010 to 2012 group. And, you know, that South Carolina team is, if you put together a list of teams that the best teams not to make it to Omaha, 2000 South Carolina is very high on that list. And, you know, the Cajuns roll into Columbia and they find a way to win that Super. And, you know, then they go on to what they went on to in Omaha. So to see the growth and, you know, the persistence of the players in that program, you know, I find to be pretty impressive on top of everything else.
Yeah, not to belabor it too much, but the idea of playing a Super Regional in the Astrodome is kind of wild to me, even, you know, knowing that as much as I've known it for forever now. Just that was, I remember reading about that. I was not there, actually. I was not in the Astrodome that day lifting the old seats and shooing the rats and cockroaches out from under the seats to be able to sit down, which I joke, but the Astrodome was showing its age at that point. And so, and clearly in 99, clearly the Astros were about to move out into Minute Maid Park. So it really was kind of at the end of its life. But the whole idea of it, they would play a Super Regional in a major league park during the season. Now, granted, that was on turf, and by turf, they mean the old version of AstroTurf, which I'm sure could not have been fun to play and slide on. But the idea that they would be able to do that basically while the big league club is out of town, I don't think that's happened. I mean, minor league parks, fairly common for college baseball postseason, but especially in the older days before there were as many really quality college baseball facilities as there are now. But big league parks, I don't think has been done before or since, really. And I have a hard time imagining it happening now. So it really is kind of a
fun. Was Reckling not an option? Like, when was Reckling not built yet?
I don't believe so. Like, or it wasn't what it is now, at the very least. So I'm guessing that was, I mean, you know, Wayne Graham could I'm sure tell us, but I, yeah, so it was built in time for the 2000 season. So they just missed. So if this is a year later, you know, if this is a year later, they're having this Reckling and it's not a thing. So in that way, I'm thankful, just because it is such a unique piece of history. And I wish there was, I actually have done Google searches for trying to find pictures or accounts of this. And you'll find a gamer or two here and there, but nothing really that I've found anyway in depth. I'd be very interested if there's someone listening who has some of that stuff, either pictures or articles written about the experience of that. I'd be really interested, but there's just not a lot out there. Considering it is only 21 years ago, different time in the world, the internet and what have you, but you would think there'd be more about that out there. But yeah, Reckling not quite done. I wasn't sure exactly when they'd finished Reckling, but yeah, 2000. So they just missed it. So we have this weird little piece of college baseball history thanks to Reckling Park not quite being finished.
Yeah, the you know, there's been talk at various times about putting something in Fenway. That's never happened. but you know, I don't even know really where like what the situation would be that you would look at this.
Yeah,
I think maybe I've looked up like UCSB might be able to host, like, but they can't host on campus. Like, where are they going to host? Like, I may have pulled up like Angels and Dodgers schedules, but like not like actually seriously.
Yeah, the only time I could think that it might have been pertinent was there was one year USD hosted, and it was like pre-Chris Bryant. We're talking like, I think they hosted in 07. It was 07 or 08. That sounds about right. And they did not have what is now Fowler Park. And so they end up hosting at Tony Gwynn Stadium at San Diego State. Now, if that Tony Gwynn
Stadium. Which also bonkers.
Right, yeah. Just let the rival come in there and play your regional there. But yeah, so they, you know, had that not been an option, like, I don't know what the Padres schedule would have been. Also, that park, Petco, would have like just been brand new. So that would have been quite something. But would the Padres have allowed that on their 2-3-year-old ballpark? I don't know. So it, again, the scenarios under which this could actually happen are just so unique, because the team has to be out of town. The team has to be willing to do it. They're really, has
and you
to
have
be
to be
like,
located like it, ha- it. It's just a small window of programs that have, you know, this being a thing. Like, you have to be good enough to host and be in or next to a big league city.
Yeah, I wonder what the backup plans were for Rice, because the thing about it is Louisiana Lafayette came through the Houston regional, and Coach Babineau references that. That was at Cougar Field, that regional. So Rice could not have even done the San Diego State plan and said, okay, like, let's see if we can talk U of H into letting us use Cougar Field to host a potential super regional, because, you know, the University of Houston was planning on at least being in the mix to play that super regional at home. So I would have really loved to know what the backup plan would have been had the Hasserdome not been available to them. I'm sure they would have come up with something, but there were some of those options that were traditionally options, or you would think would be options, weren't in that moment.
Coming in 2 months of Baseball America, Joe Healy's oral history of the 1999 Houston Super Regional.
Yeah, no kidding. Nobody steal that idea. Now that we've talked it out, nobody steal that idea. That one's too good.
I said it on the podcast, so I think that means you cannot steal it. Like, I think those are rules.
Yeah, legally speaking, you cannot steal that anymore.
Well, that's now protected by the Baseball America copyright.
That's right.
Okay, so, you know, when we look at the actual 2000 team, you know, what they came close in 99, they get there in 2000, and you look at what this team was like in Omaha, Joe, when, from what we saw in this game, I mean, it's a really talented team. Like, it's not fluky. It's not anything. Like, they just are out there and, you know, they're competing really well in Omaha. It was a close game against Stanford, which they lost to drop them into the loser's bracket to play San Jose State. They beat San Jose State, and then they play a really tight game against Clemson in an elimination game, walk them off. And, you know, everything in Omaha is showing that they very much deserve to be there, and that they could hang with everyone, which is no surprise because, again, they went to Columbia and knocked out number one overall seed, South Carolina.
Yeah, there's nothing fluky about it at all. But at the same time, it's also not one of those teams, and no great examples are coming to mind like right away, but there are occasionally teams that get to Omaha that maybe are not the teams at the top of mind. And you can see, oh, they were powered by this particularly strong pitching staff that has two big names, whether they were big leaguers or just high draft picks or really good college guys, or, oh, this team could really mash, or here's this one guy who really carried the load throughout the entire. This wasn't that. I mean, they've got some guys who played in the big league. The guy who starts the San Jose State game that we watched, Scott Doman, has a nice career in the big leagues, and he was kind of their – one thing I wanted to ask Coach Babineau about that we just didn't get around to was Scott Doman is kind of this clutch pitcher. I mean, he's the guy they go to in game three of the Super Regional against South Carolina. He's the guy they go to in the elimination game against San Jose State in Omaha. And interestingly, he was also the guy on the mound in game three, or perhaps it was game two, but I think it was game three. One of the games they lost in that 99 Super Regional against Rice, he had a chance to pitch them to Omaha and he loses that game. And so I read in the story that we talked about with Luke Johnson, who wrote it for The Advocate, that he hangs that box score up in his locker for the entire year, basically, and tells himself, if I'm in a position to pitch the team to Omaha, I'm not going to let it slip this time. And sure enough, they throw him out there on the mound in game three of a super against South Carolina, and he gets the job done. So that's a heroic performance, but this was not a team that was carried by one or two big names that you would recognize as big leaguers. And ULL has some big leaguers in their past. It's not like this is a program kind of devoid of that. But this was not that type of team. It was a very, very good team, a very talented team, but it wasn't star-studded and full of, you know, names that you'll see in lights now. And I think that's, to go back to the point about why they've captured imagination, I think that's part of it too, is they fit in that really tough to pull off space between being a juggernaut, which they weren't necessarily, but also they weren't plucky and just lucky to be there and were happy to be there. They could, I mean, in a different scenario, they get to the final here. I mean, that would not have been out of the realm of possibility. So that's really kind of, I think, unique. And I think that's also part of the reason why this team kind of captures the imagination the way they do.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I wish they, it just would have been a lot of fun to see them play LSU. That might have broken things, but, you know, Stanford took care of them twice. They beat them 19-9 in the game to send Stanford to that final against LSU, which becomes a, you know, pretty classic final in itself. That a 2000 College World Series winds up being very memorable for a whole number of reasons. But it to get two teams from the state of Louisiana going at it for a national championship would have been amazing. Although I don't know if the state of Louisiana could have handled it. I don't know if the fan bases really could have handled it, or frankly, if they really would have wanted it to be that way. I remember, you know, around here a couple years ago, the NCAA basketball tournament bracket set up in such a way that UNC and Duke could have very, very conceivably faced off for the national championship. And there was a lot of question of like, do you even want that to happen? Because if it does, then, you know, the things are just kind of broken in the rivalry, because that just becomes an ultimate, like, well, we did this, like, we beat you for the national championship. And how do you ever come back from that? So kind of an interesting, you know, fan sentiment. But unfortunately, it did not come to that. And the Cajuns story came to an end there in the semifinals of the College World Series. I mentioned I want to talk a little bit about San Jose State as well, because, you know, they're, like Joe said, they're coming at this totally differently. Their window of being a premier team is a lot shorter. You know, ULL today isn't operating at quite this level, but, you know, with the last 5 or 6 years, you can see ULL operating at the heights of college baseball. And there's every reason to believe, especially with the renovations to their ballpark and, you know, Matt Deggs, you know, being hired to replace Coach Robe, you know, that they're going to continue to, you know, pop up into the national conversation, you know, with a fair amount of frequency. But San Jose State kind of is not that program at all. And, you know, them getting to this stage is the true Cinderella story and something to be celebrated in its own right.
No doubt. And let me correct the record just quickly. I said in the kind of the open to this that they made a super regional run in 02. Full disclosure, Wikipedia has that 2002 season labeled incorrectly. They did get to a regional that season, so they were still really good. They went 45-17, but they did not get to a super. So let me correct that record there. But point being, I think that actually makes the point even more so, is that this really was a Cinderella run. And, you know, they,
speaking of that real quickly here,
sure,
they've only made the tournament 4 times, and they, like, 2000 is pretty much the only time they've done anything with it. And in 1955, they won the first 2 games in a regional and then lost the next 2. And otherwise, they're 0-2 in 71, they're 0-2 in 2002. Like, this 2000, you know, they go to Waco and they go to Houston, and, you know, they find ways to win on the road, and it's it's very much the outlier in San Jose State history.
It's also like an interesting alternate history. There are a couple of fan bases of programs who are historically very good, but are not perhaps historically great, that could be inching closer to historically great had they gotten to Omaha this year, that kind of ends up upsetting the apple cart. San Jose State did. They were in Baylor's regional, and they come out of Baylor's regional. And, you know, Baylor's a program that does get to Omaha in 05. And, you know, that ends up being, you know, the crowning achievement of the Steve Smith era there. But that's their one trip. And if they had made two during this time, it kind of changes the complexion of what they were doing. They have another one, by the way, in 2012, where they, you know, were really, really good and didn't get there. But the other one, though, is San Jose State plays the University of Houston in that super regional at Cougar Field. And the University of Houston during this period of time is perhaps, having not done the full accounting of this, I can't say definitively, but they're on the short list of the best programs during a period between like 1999 and 2003-2004 to not get to Omaha. They get to a super regional three times and they just can never break through. I mean, they just keep getting to the precipice and they just cannot break through it. They a number of times get to a third game in a super regional and they just can't do it. And so this was probably their best shot against a team. I think they came into the weekend thinking, not taking them lightly, but thinking this is our chance. So San Jose State getting to that point actually is just like a fun alternate history. It's not fun for Baylor or Houston, but is like an interesting alternate history in what I think we assumed the way that postseason was going to go. You look at the, you know, watching this game, they have a couple guys in the middle of the order who like have good numbers, but it really is a lineup of guys who don't really have numbers. It's a really unique team. They've got a second baseman, last name is Stream, who is 5'3". And they tell a story about, he's got this scar on his head. And I guess, you know, he had in the previous season in a batting practice accident, or I forget the exact details of it, but he gets hit by a stray baseball in his eye. And they have to basically split his scalp from ear to ear to repair the eye properly. And so, I mean, there's really interesting stories here, but it's in terms of like the guys in the field, like it really is just a scrappy team that I think, you know, was able to just do enough to get them into Omaha and over the hump. So it's what makes it fun. And beyond that, I mean, they competed pretty well. I mean, they didn't come there and I mean, they get behind early in their first game in Omaha, but they end up making the score look good. And in this game, they were really there with ULL, but just a true, true Cinderella underdog story, unlike few others we've seen in the history, modern history anyway, of the College World Series.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't even know who they're, I mean, I guess you can shout out Stony Brook in a similar sense, but I feel like Stony Brook getting there is much more reasonable and logical to work through, given where they had been, than San Jose State, which again, had before this 2000, you know, run, they had not been in the NCAA tournament in almost 30 years. It's you know, they truly pop up out of the blue, and wind up, you know, making this, you know, very, very impressive run, and you know, it kind of peters out a little bit after that. Like, yes, they do make it back in 2002, but it's, you know, back to the NCAA tournament in 2002, but it's, there's not been much like this in San Jose State's history before, and absolutely not since.
Yeah, it's definitely you talk about where programs are now, you went down this road a little bit earlier, but, you know, ULL was a national seed in 14. They hosted, I believe they hosted in 15 or perhaps it was 16, but still very good, just a matter of a few years ago. And San Jose State has just had a lot of trouble really as a member of the Mountain West Conference, just really being, you know, consistent and having any sort of consistency. They've really, really struggled. And it really is just kind of crazy how much the history of San Jose State kind of looks like. If you were to draw like a curve, theirs is less of like a bell curve and more of a mountain, you know, just like a very, very high peak with an immediate drop off on like either side of it. So Just really crazy, really crazy piece of history there. Shout out also on San Jose State for left fielder Rob Douglas, who is rocking a pair of just regular old glasses out there. Not like athlete. Now, see, now they've got like the really fancy, like Oakley style, like shades that just have prescription lenses instead of dark lenses. Like those have been out for quite a while now. There was also, of course, at different points, and I've seen this because I've been watching the Last Dance documentary on ESPN, but the Horace Grant goggles with the strap, I mean, those have been around. Chris Sabo, famously, former podcast guest, Chris Sabo, famously wore those. But no, this Rob Douglas guy, he's just wearing a pair of regular old glasses. And I'm someone
who... That's the Greg Maddux look, right?
Right, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, I'm someone who wore glasses on the baseball field when I was playing and up through high school. And so I felt it deeply when he would stand in the batter's box and he would take a pitch and he'd step back out and he'd be doing his like between pitches routine, which included a push up of his glasses with his finger. I was like, my man, I totally understand. Trying to keep those glasses up when your face is sweaty is not an easy thing to do. And they told a, I kind of missed some of the story here, but I guess he had recently got those glasses and they make a joke. He goes 3 for 4 and he's at one point 3 for 3. And, you know, Harold Reynolds or Mike Patrick, I forget which, makes a joke about like, man, if they'd have gotten those glasses earlier, he might have hit 400 because he really is stinging the ball. So it sounded like it was one of those stories where, you know, there were some struggles and they put a pair of glasses on him and all of a sudden, oh, that's what the problem was. So so shouts to Rob Douglas and his glasses, because it certainly made me feel like, you know, the teenage version of Joe was not that far from being a college baseball player, at least in that one respect.
So we also did want to kind of touch on just the uniqueness of this game in terms of the, you know, these two programs being underdog programs, being a little bit outside the traditional power structure of college baseball. And like I mentioned, if you really look at the history of the College World Series since the format was changed in terms of how regionals were constructed, this is not something that happens pretty much ever, except in this one instance where programs like this end up meeting each other on the biggest stage of the sport. You might have instances like in 2012 where Kent State and Stony Brook are there together, but they just don't play. And it is a little different here where you do have these teams on the field together. One of them is guaranteed to move on. You know, they're not getting eliminated. And, you know, so can this happen again? Is the sport just in a spot where it can't happen again? And I know Joe has thoughts on that, and I do as well. But Joe, just what do you think of that, and what do you make of what that means for kind of where college baseball is versus where it was 20 years ago?
I think the San Jose State piece, I think, could happen again, because that's ultimately just a talented team that just got super hot at the right time. Or you don't even have to really get that hot. I mean, you can lose games in regionals and super regionals and still get through. It makes it harder, but a team that just started playing its best baseball at the right time, I think that part could happen again, because it does happen. The piece that seems harder to pull off is to do what ULL was doing in the way that they did it, because college baseball still in the 90s, which is when this all really started for the Raging Cajuns, was still a blank canvas in a lot of ways. And we've talked about this a little bit before, where it was still a blank canvas in that there were fewer programs that were really committed to baseball in terms of facilities or in terms of budgets, in terms of taking seriously, you know, doing some of the things you need to do to be successful. There were a lot of programs that were just kind of existing, just to put it a fine point on it. So you could be a program like Louisiana Lafayette or Southwestern Louisiana and hire Tony Robichaud, and he's just a uniquely qualified coach to get that done. I mean, he had a lot of success in McNeese State before that, so he's in a good position to get it done. He knows the landscape, and you've got this untapped potential that he's able to realize in that program. a program that's been brought up several times in this podcast. Rice was in a similar position. They had some unique challenges because of the cost of attendance, the academic piece, all of that, even less history. I mean, they were really nowhere in terms of a program. And because of that blank canvas in college baseball, they were able to build something out of that. And that's the part that I don't know is replicable today, because I'm trying to come up with an avatar for what this looks like today. Like, what's the program that could do what ULL did then and would be kind of a similar trajectory? And I can't really come up with it. I mean, like, East Carolina has never been to Omaha, but they're too successful. Like, they are universally regarded as the best program to never go to Omaha. And if they were to go to Omaha in 2021, like, yes, they would be first time Omaha participant. But their track record of success is almost too good to be the same type of program as what ULL was. ULL was a crowning achievement of what had been a somewhat lengthy, but mostly pretty swift building job. You know, East Carolina has gone through several head coaches, all of whom have had various levels of success by and large. And then, you know, getting to Omaha would kind of be a capper and they'd finally get over that hump. And I know Cliff Godwin is all about getting that done because he cares for that program so much. But that, to me, that wouldn't be the same. And so I just don't know what the modern day I don't know that there's a modern day version of a program now in a league that would allow you to do this. Because that's the other piece. I don't think you can do this from a one bid league, because really
you're talking about Indiana, right?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, it's different because the Big Ten is what it is. But, you know, I feel like when Indiana did it, the Big Ten wasn't that necessarily. Right. Now, I mean, that's easy to say, but the Big Ten is still the Big Ten. But, you know, and if Iowa did it today, I don't think it would be the same way. But, you know, Indiana kind of ushers in this new era of Big Ten baseball in some respects.
Yeah, that's a good one, because see, that's a really interesting point too, because doing that now, to your point about Iowa, doing that now would not be the same, I don't think. So is it like Dallas Baptist? But even that track record is pretty lengthy at this point. So is it Indiana State, to keep it in the Hoosier State? Because the Valley feels like that type of league where I couldn't tell you exactly what the Sun Belt Conference was like in 1999 and 2000, but I assume it was pretty competitive, kind of like it was not long after that before realignment jumbled stuff up. But the Valley is a multi-bid league more often than not, has teams that could conceivably win regionals, because that's the first piece of this now, is like, could you see a team winning, this team winning a regional? So maybe it's a team from the Valley, perhaps. You know, I'm not really sure, but I think that's this all serves to make the point I'm making, which is I just don't know. And you and I have had probably at this point literal multiple hours of conversation about this exact topic, which JJ Cooper would tell us means we need to write about it. But I just don't know.
In fairness to that, it was on the schedule before coronavirus happened.
True, that is true. So we're getting to it, is what we're saying. So again, don't steal that idea either. But yeah, in 2020 or 2021 college baseball, I don't know. I just don't know that what they did then is replicated in this. It could be replicated in the same way. And of course, I say that until it happens, right? I mean, like the other side of this argument is that none of this stuff really feels possible until it happens. If you'd ask somebody in 1993, hey, 10 years from now, is Rice going to win a national title in baseball? They would have laughed at you. It would have been right to do so. So that's the other piece of this is, yes, there are trends in college baseball. And right now the trend is away from mid-major programs. And I don't know if that ever shifts fully back, but things ebb and flow. And so will this happen again? Probably, if you give it enough time. But is it as easily done? And will we see examples of ULL does this, and then Rice does this? And to a certain degree, I think sometimes this gets forgotten. Southern Miss gets to Omaha in 2009. Programs have done this, and there were a decent number of them in rapid succession. And I just don't know that the conditions are such that we could see something like that again. So will it happen again? Probably. Will we see it coming? No. And could it happen as in rapid succession as it used to? Probably not.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's definitely going to be rarer going forward, but I think that you know, again, Indiana's an iffy example because of their situation in the Big Ten. And the Big Ten, as long as it was not paying very good attention to college baseball, was a sleeping giant. And I think you're seeing why it's a sleeping giant. You know, despite all of the various factors that work against Big Ten schools, they're still Big Ten schools, and they're still the biggest schools in states that have a lot of population. You know, at least if we're talking about Illinois and Indiana and Ohio State and or Ohio rather and Michigan, you know, these are big time schools in big states that carry a lot of weight if they decide to throw their weight behind baseball, which they now are. But I think also UCSB is not that far off from this, that, you know, that's a team that hosted in 2015, gets to Omaha in 2016, was kind of on the bubble of hosting for a lot of 19. As things were setting up this year, it was kind of looking like, well, maybe they're going to be a fringe top 25 team. Maybe they are a top 25 team. I think that's how we're looking at the Gauchos going into 21. So I think they're kind of similar to that. Now we can talk about, like, is the Big West just too big for this to be a thing? You know, I don't know.
I don't think it is anymore. Dallas. That's kind of the funny thing about it, is I think if we had this conversation 10 years ago, we'd go, yeah, probably. But now, well, the Big West is in a place where I think it's actually back on the board as a possibility.
Sure. And I think that Dallas Baptist, when they get to Omaha, it is going to be seen as a breakthrough, but I think it may be seen more as a breakthrough akin to what Coastal did, that, like, it was coming for so long. And I'm not saying that the first time TBU gets to Omaha, they win the national title. But when Coastal got there in 16, not so much the way we look at it now, but when it happened, it was a little bit more like, oh, okay, so Coastal finally did this, and, like, welcome to the club. And I think that might be a little more where TBU is. But, you know, I think there is still a chance to be the kind of program building, to have the kind of program building that ULL did at the turn of the century. And, you know, I actually find it maybe a little less likely that we see teams like San Jose State pop up. You know, it's not that long ago that we saw, you know, some teams like that. You know, VCU was at a super regional not so long ago. And, you know, that's just, you know, you one more step to make it to Omaha. Davidson, obviously, you know, famously upsets North Carolina, but, you know, those teams have not fared so well in super regionals. And I just feel like in today's world, to be a four seed or even a three, like, you know, not so much a bubble three like a Michigan or a Duke last year, but to be a auto bid three and go through the two weekends, it's very, very hard to do that on the road in today's environment, and to do the, you know, just, it's two weekends, it's, you know, six, seven games, whatever, however many you end up playing against elite competition. And I find that to be maybe the harder thing to pull off, to be someone as fully off the map as San Jose State, to go out and do that. And, you know, I know that San Jose State team individually was good, but for a program that traditionally has not been that kind of program, to put together a team like that, you know, that's, I find that to be maybe the harder thing to do in today's landscape. And, you know, obviously the program building is very difficult to pull off, but I think we can find examples of that, at least in the last 10 years. I, you know, outside of Stony Brook, I don't know who your example of that would be. You know, and even again, Stony Brook is a little different because that team was and is one of the powerhouses of the America East Conference, which means that they end up in the NCAA tournament with a fair amount of regularity. And, you know, if you keep having those kinds of experiences, you know, it eventually doesn't take a whole lot to a whole lot of imagination to believe that you can, you know, win a regional and then, you know, have what it takes to go on the road and win a super, and to have, you know, the talent because you're developing players, or you're getting, you know, lucky in recruiting, or you're just doing a really good job at identifying talent. Like that all seems like it's just very difficult to pull off if you're living so far outside the power structure. And I don't know whether the current environment that we're in makes that harder or not, but, you know, especially right now, if you're going to be doing it on less scholarships, Davidson figured out how to go out and win a regional, but, you know, there's that whole next step that becomes very difficult, having to compete head to head, you know, with so much pressure on the road for a trip to Omaha, winning 2 out of 3 games. I mean, that's a big ask, I feel like.
Yeah, it's one of those deals where like a statistical modeler would tell us that, well, it kind of depends, because, you know, the year to year Cinderella thing, you have more shots at it because every year there's 16 four seeds that are going to have a bite at the apple, right? And so like you are kind of getting 16 lottery tickets. And that the building thing takes time, and you're talking about a smaller number of places. So it's like in the abstract, you might look at the four seed thing as being more common because you get those every single year. Like most people don't know this, but you have to put 64 teams into the NCAA tournament baseball bracket. Shouts to Gary Parrish.
So it's true. You do.
So like people don't know that, but you do. So every year there are 16 four seeds and 16 three seeds. So you get a whole bunch of bites at the apple on that. Of course, most of those lottery tickets come up empty, but so there's that piece of it. But then to your point, I agree with you. To your point, there are always programs building under the surface. And sometimes we get to see the fruits of that labor. And sometimes we don't, because things just don't work out. So it's an interesting debate. And I don't know that, you know, obviously we get to see it play out, which is the fun part, because these things are all, we get to see the results. But in some respects, it's just impossible to know until we see it play out. So it's a fun debate to have that plays out in slow motion over a number of years.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, these things, elements change. You know, if we wind up changing the regional format and the NCAA decides to adopt the plan, being supported by some, or the idea, I shouldn't say plan, that kind of implies that it's a proposal out there, but the idea that you should have an extra round, so instead of regionals, everyone plays best of three series all the way through, you know, maybe that makes it easier for one type of this, you know, underdog team than the other. My guess is that would make it easier, a little bit easier for the program building team. But, you know, as things ebb and flow and change in terms of structure of college baseball, you know, you see different kinds of things. But this specific game in the 2000 College World Series is kind of, you know, it's certainly a unique moment, and it's, while it's not singular, it is something that you cannot expect to come along very often, even when you get multiple teams in, you know, making debuts, breaking through as Cinderellas in 1 year. To have them be matched up, it doesn't happen often. And so that is one of the cool elements that the 2000 College World Series provided, and that we were able to see, you know, in this particular game.
Yeah, I guess my final thought is we talked about how much fun this team was, and there were a lot of things that played into that. Some of it was the style of play for sure. Some of it was the blonde hair, and we got a package in this game that showed actual footage of the guys going to that, which that's something that I feel like we don't see much anymore in like these College World Series games. And I guess part of it is just because it's now the CWS is so much of a bigger deal in terms of how it's blown out coverage wise. So maybe there's just not that opportunity, but we actually got a full blown like package of a camera following UL baseball players to the store to buy the dye and then going into their hotel room to dye each other's hair. It was just kind of a fun little deal. And so that was part of it. And then I think the other thing is that this program was kind of a, a sleeping giant in terms of not just what they could accomplish on the field, but also it's a fan base that really, really cares in a state that really, really cares about college baseball. So I think it was a sleeping giant in that regard as well. I mean, the park they have now, Russo, doesn't exist. Even if they go to the CWS, it probably doesn't exist if there wasn't the demand for that and the fan demand. But they draw really well. Those fans really, really care. And I think that's part of what made it special too, is you just knew this was this fan base getting to do this, you know, this fun thing and all go to Omaha and cheer their team on or watch from home. Or I'm sure there were all kinds of parties all over that part of the country to celebrate their team getting there. And I think that's part of what made it fun too.
Absolutely. It was a fun one to look back on, and I'm glad we were able to spend some time on it as we dig through the archives in this very, very strange spring. So we'll be back here next week with another game to rewatch, another trip down memory lane to take. We're still kind of organizing our thoughts as to which game that'll be. So look for, if you're interested in watching the game beforehand, I would recommend tuning into our first podcast of next week, which will be released on Tuesday, or checking us out on social media. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. If you're looking for more of the Baseball America College podcast, make sure you're subscribed in your favorite podcasting app, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you're getting your podcasts, you can find the Baseball America podcast. So please subscribe, please rate, please review. We appreciate all of that. When you guys, let us know you're listening out there. We love to hear that. You can find plenty more content over on the website, baseballamerica.com. There's a lot of college content, a lot of draft content, a lot of stuff to take you through, this spring and into June. We've got a lot going on in the lead up to the draft, and of course, continuing to cover the college game and the news and everything that comes out of, this very, very strange spring. So make sure to check that out as well if you are so inclined. I want to thank Coach Babineau again for joining us here on the Baseball America College podcast. Thank you to Joe. Thank you all for listening. I've been Teddy Cahill. We'll see you next time.